Did you know that in the United States, every year 1.5 million people simply vanish? Some of them are children abducted while on their ways to or from school. Others simply disappear from their homes. Most of them manage to be found. A small percentage will never be discovered. Most of the time, it's trusted friends or family members. Sometimes it's at the hands of dangerous offenders that states' law enforcement groups have either failed to acknowledge or recognize, or have previously captured and then released on parole or due to legal contingency. 3.2% of that number is related to people who are abducted at the hands of cults, religious organizations, or quote-unquote other unknown circumstances. Now, having been a member of that 3.2% myself, I can say it is a greatly underappreciated value. Either way, so good to be home. Hello, everyone. My name is Jonas Armitage, and you're listening to Stories from Dark Places. I would like to thank you all for having me back. It is a pleasure to be here for the beginning of Season 2 of our little broadcast. And I would not be here today were it not for the members of my staff here at WZHP Radio Innsmouth, specifically Danielle and her husband Donato, as well as others who called in or assisted us across the internet. It's been a rather trying few months. I thought perhaps I might tell you a little about what happened. Also, as a special treat, we've been asked by a local member of the community if we might play a song of theirs on the radio this evening. As some of you know, I was abducted out of the studio booth a few months ago. Two strangers with a rather scaly complexion appeared in the booth and rendered me unconscious before absconding with me. When I awoke, I was in a small stone cavern with bars fitted on it. I was able to track the movements of the sky through a hole in the ceiling. It didn't give me much more other than the smell of the sea and a perception of day and night. As I was there, I began to hear the sounds of others, and they began bringing more people in. One particularly animated such was a gentleman who dropped a phone while they were struggling to contain him. The one that I acquired and used to leave my special message to everyone. I apologize for the rather dour sound at the time, but there was a part of me that was afraid that I would never see any of you again. Or speak to you again, I should say. We were not fed regularly, and any water was gathered from rain that fell through the opening in the ceiling. They would bring food sometimes, but usually it would come at the behest of abuse. They were interested, at least in my end, to try and make me rescind the things that I had said. They wanted to make an example of me, of those who would speak about things that should not be spoken. But there was a time I thought perhaps I would die down there. Anyway, that's enough of that for now. I think this is a good time for us to cut away, so that we can allow our guest to perform his song for us. Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you Travis from the Tesoro. Hey there, Cthulhu, I exist while you are dreaming in Raliu, the sunken city. No one else believes in you, but that's just fine. They will understand and fear you in due time. It is sublime. Oh, great Cthulhu, I will memorize each ritual and etch them all inside my skull. I will achieve communion, this I vow. These arcane rites will stir your mind somehow, should fate allow. You are not dead, but do eternal lie. And in strange eon sometimes even death may die. You are not dead, but do eternal lie. And in strange eons, even death may die. Even death may die. Abdul Al-Hazred wrote the words that let the madness in, and penned each verse on human skin. The Necronomicon contains the key to flay apart banal reality and set you free. O Yog-Sothoth, please rend the veil and come before me. I shall trepanate my skull and let the ancient words of power trickle in. They itch and fester underneath my skin. It now begins. You are not dead, but do eternal lie. And in strange eons, even death may die. You are not dead, but do eternal lie. And in strange eons, even death may die. The seasons change, the stars align, the shambler comes through space and time. At last I feel you stirring underneath. As foretold by the elder spawn, the veil of sanity is gone. Behold their many eyes and gnashing teeth. Your bottomless and ancient gazes heralding the end of days. The sun has set upon the age of man by your command. The cult of Dagon has begun their final sacrament. Discard your fears, do not lament. They took my eyes and now I finally see this massive cosmic tapestry. Each human thought himself supreme, but now we're all just echoes of the dream, his waking dream. You are not dead, but do eternal lie. And in strange eons, even death may die. You are not dead, but do eternal lie. And in strange eons, even death may die. Even death may die. Whoa. Thank you, Travis, for that lovely song. It's quite well done, I think. Tell us what you think about it. Hit us up on Twitter. Send us an email at storiesfromdarkplaces@gmail.com. Or leave us a comment on YouTube once this goes up there. Now, initially we hadn't planned on having a story, but given the shortness of tonight's broadcast, I thought I'd wrap this up with an American classic. Lady Eleanor's Mantle, written by Nathaniel Hawthorne. When America was still a British colony, a young woman, Lady Eleanor Rochecliffe, traveled from England to become the ward of Governor Shute of Massachusetts Bay. The gentleman and his wife were Eleanor's only surviving relatives, and very happy to have her stay in Province House, the governor's home in Boston. Lady Eleanor was beautiful, witty, well-educated, and extremely proud of her place in the world. She wanted nothing to do with anyone who was not as high-born and rich as herself. She was not at all sure that the colonies had much to offer her after life in London at the royal court. But she was quite impressed when the governor sent an elegant coach, drawn by 4 sleek black horses, to meet her ship and carry her to Province House. He also arranged for a gallant escort of gentlemen on horseback to ride before and behind her coach. People in the street glimpsed Lady Eleanor through the large glass windows of the coach and thought she looked very much like a queen, though she was still in her teens. But what caused the most comment was her embroidered mantle, which had been woven by the most skillful seamstress in London. Its gold, silver, and red threads seemed to catch fire from the late afternoon sun, so that the young woman appeared wrapped in a cloak of flame. When the coachman reined in his 4 black steeds in front of Province House, a nearby church bell tolled for a funeral. Everyone was upset that its morning clang accompanied Lady Eleanor's arrival. Just then, as Governor Shute and his wife approached the carriage to assist their ward in climbing down, a pale young man with tangled hair rushed from the crowd and fell in the dust at Eleanor's feet, offering his back as her footstool. "Get up, sir," roared the governor, threatening to beat the young man with his cane. "Don't strike him," said Eleanor scornfully. "When men want to be trampled on, I am happy to give them the favor they desire." Light as a sunbeam on a cloud, she placed her foot upon the waiting back, extended her hand to meet that of the governor, and stepped down. "Who is this insolent fellow?" the governor's wife demanded. "Gervase Helwise," replied the governor's doctor, "a youth without position or fortune, but of good mind, until he met Lady Eleanor in London. He fell in love with her, but she would have nothing to do with anyone in such humble circumstances. Her scorn drove him mad." "He was mad even to dream of approaching so noble a lady as my ward," said the governor, signaling the discussion was at an end. A few days after the incident, a ball was given in honor of Lady Eleanor's arrival. Province House was filled with the riches and most noteworthy gentry in Boston. The lady shone in rich silks and satins, spread out over wide hoops. The gentlemen glittered with gold embroidery laid unsparingly on the purple or scarlet or sky-blue velvet of their coat and waistcoats. The place was alive with voices, laughter, and music. But no one drew the eye and admiration of the crowd like Lady Eleanor, and her mantle gave an added majesty and mystery to her. The story went around that it had been made by a dying girl and had the magic power of giving new grace and beauty to the wearer every time it was put on. It was said that the fanciful birds and animals and flowers that adorned it were the product of a mind grown delirious with approaching death. To some of those looking at the young woman, it seemed that the strange magic of the mantle gave her an almost feverish flush, while others thought it made her skin look as pale as the most delicate bone china. Eleanor herself seemed as changeable. Sometimes she chattered and laughed excitedly with certain select guests, and just as often she seemed moody and withdrawn and tired to the point of fainting. While the guests were taking refreshment, Lady Eleanor settled into a large damask chair with a sigh, chattering with the governor's doctor, who noted her sudden weariness with a professional eye. Suddenly, Gervase Helwise appeared, kneeling at her feet, having slipped unnoticed through the side door. "I beg you, dear lady, throw off the mantle," he cried. "It may not be too late. Throw the accursed thing in the fire." But Lady Eleanor, with a scornful laugh, drew the rich folds of the embroidered mantle around her head so that it threw her features half into shadow and gave her a mysterious look. "Leave me," she mocked, "but always remember me as you see me now." At this, he was dragged from the room by the doctor and several other gentlemen and servants, who shoved him roughly out the iron gate of Province Hall and slammed it shut with a loud clang. As the night wore on, the weariness in Eleanor's manner increased. Her face grew flushed. She smiled because it seemed too much effort to speak. The doctor whispered something in the governor's ear that changed the man's cheerful expression to one of fear and worry. A few moments later, it was announced that unforeseen circumstances made it necessary to end the party immediately. Puzzled, the guests went home. The curious events at the ball were quickly forgotten when, a few days later, the city was thrown into panic by an outbreak of smallpox, which in those days could not be prevented or cured. At first, the disease struck only the proud, the well-born, and the wealthy, though it soon spread throughout the whole city and countryside. It was pointed out that the first to fall victim were persons who had attended Lady Eleanor's ball at Province House. In fact, the blood-red flag that marked every house where smallpox had entered had first been seen waving over the door of Province House. Though no one outside the house had seen Lady Eleanor since the night of the ill-fated ball, it was rumored that the disease had crossed the sea from London in her gorgeous mantle. It was said that fate and misery had been woven in its gold and silver threads by a woman already dying of the disease. People whispered that this had been a punishment for Eleanor for her pride and cruelty. People cursed her and called each red flag a warning, a new triumph for the Lady Eleanor. They shunned Province House and most of its inhabitants fled, so there was no one to stop Gervais Helwys when he entered one evening. Quickly, he climbed the stairs to the upper hallway, throwing open door after door, calling, "Lady Eleanor!" At last, in the gloom of a darkened chamber, a woman's voice murmured, "A drop of water! My throat is scorched!" Gervais stepped a little way into the room, spotting the mantle into which a dead woman had innocently embroidered a spell of dreadful power. He shuddered. Then he drew near the canopied bed, where something stirred behind the silken curtains. He pulled the drape apart and saw a skeletal figure that tried to hide a hideous face with claw-like hands. "Do not look at me," the woman croaked. "Who are you?" asked the young man, fascinated and repelled by the vision. "What are you doing in my lady's chamber?" "I am the one who wrapped myself in pride as in a mantle and scorned you," she rasped. "Now you are revenged. I am Eleanor Rochecliffe."
"Another triumph for the Lady Eleanor," cried Gervais, driven mad by her words. "All have been her victims. It is fitting the final victim is herself." Then, laughing wildly, he snatched up the mantle and ran from Province House. That night, a torchlit procession, led by Gervais, carried the straw figure of a woman, wrapped in a fantastically embroidered mantle, to the square in front of Province House. There the mob burned the effigy, and a strong wind came and swept the ashes away. And it was said from that hour the disease abated, as if, from first to last, it had some mysterious connection with Lady Eleanor's mantle. No one knew the lady's fate for certain, but for a long time afterward, there was talk that in a certain chamber of the mansion, a woman's ghostly form could be seen, shrinking into the shadows and muffling her face with a richly embroidered mantle. That's all the time we have for now. Good night, listeners. And remember, the next time you're walking along, you feel a sense of dread creep up the nape of your neck, remember, there's nothing to be afraid of. After all, some of the best things only happen in the dark.
Stories from Dark Places was recorded before an imaginary studio audience. All stories performed on this podcast have express written consent from the original author. Jonas Armitage, his studio manager, and the entire staff of WZHP Radio Innsmouth are fictitious characters, and it's probably for the best that you continue to believe that.